Going Linux, episode 25. Why switch to Linux? Welcome to the Going Linux podcast. I'm your host, Larry Bushy.
And I'm your co-host, Tom.
The Going Linux podcast is designed to provide you with practical, day-to-day advice on how to use Linux to get things done.
If you're new to Linux, moving to Linux, or thinking about going Linux, then this podcast is for you.
In our user experience episodes, we take 2 months to cover a topic.
During the first month, we introduce the topic for new Linux users and recent converts to the operating system.
During month two, we discuss the same topic from a more advanced perspective for users of Linux building their confidence and competence with the operating system.
And between user experience episodes, we have listener feedback episodes from you.
Today, an interview from the Southern California Linux Expo and why switch to Linux?
Good question. In this episode, we're breaking away from our normal format a little bit. This is not going to be divided into 2 months. We're just going to talk to you today about why you might want to switch to Linux.
That's right. And we'll have our regular episode of listener feedback next time. But the follow-on after that will be an introduction episode to our next topic.
Right. We're not going to have advanced why switch to Linux.
So why should somebody switch to Linux from anything else, Tom?
I can only come at it from my perspective, and that was I was a Windows user. Mm-hmm. And as a Windows user, I found that when I first installed Windows, everything ran nice. And then as the weeks went on, and sometimes months, the machine would slow down, and things would break, quit working. And I'd have to find workarounds, and there was no support. And finally, I'd have to reinstall again and get a fresh start over and over and over. And that's reason number one for me that I got out of it. And then All the reasons I discovered afterwards, well, that's what we'll talk about here.
Well, as for me, I'm a recovering Windows user as well, and
I feel your pain, brother.
Yeah. I use Windows at work exclusively simply because that's the operating system that work uses. They don't use anything other than Windows, and so I'm forced to continue to use it in that environment. But to make it even worse, I'm kind of a Windows expert at work.
Yeah.
And so people tend to come to me anyway for advice on technology. And I found myself as a power user of Windows in the same situation as you were, having to reinstall Windows, but probably even more frequently because of the fact that I'm a power user of Windows. And It's really annoying. I mean, I know all of the tips and tricks as to how to keep spam and viruses and you know, spyware
but
and all of the malware. Yeah. To keep all of that stuff off and what to do and what not to do and how to turn on the firewall and all of that stuff. But as some other podcasters have said about Windows, you really have to be a security expert these days to run Windows. And I just got fed up with the whole mess.
It's not even safe to have a Windows machine plugged into the internet these days.
Well, certainly not without a router between you and the internet.
Right. And even then.
Even then, yeah, there are a lot of things you can do from a behavioral perspective, opening attachments and things that aren't as bad with Linux because most of the malware is written for Windows and not for Linux. So it's not as likely to hurt you even if it does get into your Linux computer, which is one of the reasons for using Linux.
Sure.
You're less susceptible to these problems.
Yeah, when someone asks me to look at a computer problem for them, I sit down and say, well, I see your problem. you're running Windows.
There's your problem right there.
Yeah. Let's tear this out of here.
Yeah, I don't go quite that far, but if somebody mentions the fact that they're looking for something new, or they have a new computer, or a computer that may not be new, but they are looking for something to put on it because they can't afford Windows, or, you know, Windows is expensive.
Real expensive.
Have you taken a
look? You did a breakdown
of
that a while back.
Yeah, I did.
Not on the air, though, did we? No.
No, we haven't talked about it on the air. Let me just pull up that file here real quick, because that's probably something good to take a look at. Yeah, here it is. Okay. What I did was I looked at the cost of configuring a computer with Linux, and I was looking at Ubuntu as one of the most popular varieties of Linux out there, and comparing how much it would cost to configure an equal system with Windows Vista. And as you can imagine, there are various ways you can configure this thing, but I tried to make it as apples and apples as possible. So starting with, let's assume that you already have the computer hardware.
Let's back up on that assumption a little bit. We can assume that, but let's say at the top that if you're going to run Vista, you need a pretty powerful machine.
So for sake of argument here, then let's say we have a machine that you've been running Windows 98 or even Windows XP on, and you want to upgrade. How's that sound?
Yeah.
Okay, so we're starting with you have the hardware, and you've been running something on it in the past, and now it's time to upgrade the operating system. Maybe you just want to get something a little bit new.
Sure.
So the average user would take a look at, the average Windows user would take a look at Windows Vista as an alternative. So what do you need to run Windows Vista? Well, first of all, you need a copy of the program. All right, so which Windows Vista are you going to get? Are you going to get Windows Vista Home Premium Upgrade? Are you upgrading? Or are you going to get Windows Vista Ultimate? And for now, let's take a look at two possibilities here. One is the upgrader, who can actually upgrade their software, and then the other one whose Windows has crashed so badly that it's not operational and they have to go out and replace it with something. And that's typically, I think, where somebody gets into the mode of saying, well, Windows is going to cost me too much. What else is out there?
Right.
And let's not go top of the line here for the upgrade. Let's just say we've got Windows Vista Home Premium Upgrade, which is probably, you could probably get away with Vista Home Basic, but some of the basic elements of even Windows XP are missing from that. So let's assume we're going with an upgrade. That, last time I priced it out, which admittedly was a little while ago, was $160 for the upgrade.
Okay.
If you went with the top-of-the-line Windows Vista Ultimate, not upgrading, just go out there and buy it off the shelf, $400. And I'm sure you can go out there and you can get OEM versions and other tricks to reduce the price. But let's say you don't have all the connections to get all the price breaks that maybe you could get, and you just walk down to your big box store and you just pick up a box of Windows software off the shelf.
Right.
$400 is probably what you're going to be paying for it.
Right. Now, that's before you've really got Office applications, right?
Oh, yeah, that's right. I mean, when you install your Linux operating system, for most of the popular Linux operating systems, you get applications pre-installed,
right,
like an Office suite, whether it's KOffice or
OpenOffice.
That's the one I was trying to think of. And all of that comes pre-installed, where if you want to install, let's just say OpenOffice. Let's keep it comparable here. OpenOffice is pretty full-featured, well-configured with just about anything you'd need and want in an Office suite for the average user. Okay, so in our upgrade configuration from Windows, first of all, you have to decide which version of Microsoft Office do you want.
Right.
Do you want the Home and Student Edition, or do you want the Microsoft Office 2007 Ultimate Edition?
Ooh, Ultimate.
Yeah, so let's, for our basic upgrade configuration, let's say you can get the Home and Student Edition. Any idea how much that costs, Tom?
Shot in the dark, $300.
Not quite. It's about $150.
Okay.
Yeah, for the Home and Student Edition. Now, there are other, you know, licenses for that that you can pay.
Sure.
Up to, for the full feature, non-upgrade version. Oh, by the way, for Microsoft Office, they don't offer upgrade versions anymore.
Oh.
No, you have to buy
that simplifies things.
The full featured version. Yeah. And I think for the average user, the Home and Student Edition would be what people would purchase. But let's say you're using it for work. You're not a student. You're not using it at home, and you want to be good about the whole thing, and you want to buy the appropriate license. So you go out and for your full-featured version of your computer here, you go out and buy Microsoft Office 2007 Ultimate. Take a stab in the dark how much that one costs, Tom.
I'm going to stay with the $300.
Not quite. $680, I've seen it. Now, that's without any discounts or, you know, I'm sure it goes on sale on some stores.
Sure.
But if you were to just walk into a store and they didn't have a sale on, you could be spending $680 for a copy of Microsoft Office.
Wow. Do we have a spreadsheet yet?
A spreadsheet? Yes. With Microsoft Office, you do get a spreadsheet and a word processor.
Well, that's nice.
And a presentation software.
Okay.
You don't get a database manager. You don't get a lot of other stuff. So basic Office sort of application there. So, Tom, take a guess at how much OpenOffice costs. I know you don't have to guess, but this is fun.
let's see. I paid cash, and it was free.
Free, yes. I got my discount, and they gave me 0% off of $0, so it was free. Yeah.
Free, yeah. And if you use the code Going Linux, you get it free.
You get 50% off of that cost.
Yeah.
Yes.
So the total expenditure so far is somewhere in the many hundreds of dollars for Microsoft. And how does that compare to Linux?
For Linux, so far we've got a grand total of, let me see here, $0, 0 cents.
$0, 0 cents. Okay.
So, anyway, I think Linux comes out a little cheaper at this point.
Right.
Okay, so with Microsoft's operating system, you get a web browser, so you can browse the web. But let's say you also want to have an offline mail client with Linux applications, depending on which application you install. You have some sort of mail client, Thunderbird,
sure.
Or Evolution. Is it Evolution? I think it's Evolution.
Yeah, mine came with Evolution, but I'm using Thunderbird. I like it a lot better.
Yeah, so do I. And Thunderbird is free. So, yes. Now, here's where the real bargain comes in with Windows and Microsoft Office. If we're considering our full system here where you're buying everything from scratch, not upgrading, the Ultimate Edition of Microsoft Office that we just paid $680 for comes with Microsoft Mail.
Yeah, okay. It still doesn't feel like free.
Yeah. Even though you get it for free with your $680 purchase?
Yeah, I don't know.
With the Home and Student Edition and our upgraded computer, if you really want Microsoft Outlook, you're going to have to pay, or an equivalent. I'm not even sure they're offering Outlook anymore. You'd be paying an equivalent of about $110 for that, just for a mail application. And, of course, you can install Thunderbird or OpenOffice or any of these free open source programs onto your Windows computer. But let's just say you like the Microsoft experience and the wow. So you are willing to fork over the money. So far our subtotal for our upgraded system where we're starting with Windows XP or Windows 98 and we're upgrading and we're buying just kind of the minimal purchase from Microsoft is about $420 for software. But now if you really think about it, you've got the cost of your previous operating system,
right,
the cost of your previous office suite, because you had to purchase those in order to qualify for the upgrade.
Right.
And you still can't run Windows Vista, more than likely, because you don't have good enough hardware. You need to add some RAM. You need to add some additional hardware, perhaps a better video card. Who knows, until you actually try to install it, what your computer is going to say you need,
right,
in order to run Vista properly.
And Vista might look at your video card and say, that's not a secure card. It doesn't have DRM built into it. I'm sorry, you can't use that to its full capabilities.
Yeah, I don't know what it does at that point. I've only had my hands on Vista a couple of times, so what's that all about, Tom?
Built into the agreement that Microsoft makes manufacturers conform to are rules that make it impossible, or at least try to make it impossible, for anybody to, let's say, rip a CD or rip a DVD. And so, for instance, I don't remember the exact numbers, but there's a thing where each device has to pull itself once in a while to see if anything's monkeying with it. And it has to do that, I think it was 60 times or 600 times per second to see if there's been a breach of security. Now, you need a really, really fast machine to still keep chugging along while all of the devices are checking themselves. And if they do think that they've detected some intrusion, they're supposed to reset.
Mm-hmm.
And because I really can't remember everything here, it sounds like I don't know what I'm talking about, but we will put a link in the show notes to Cory Doctorow's four-part podcast of Peter Gutmann's wonderful document, A Cost Analysis of Windows Vista Content Protection, that goes through their agreement, which he calls the longest suicide note in the history of the world. And people can listen to that and find out what the heck it is I'm talking about.
Yeah, there's a lot of good listening in there, and it does open your eyes to
it sure does.
What this whole DRM thing is about.
Now, just to be fair, the one thing that you don't get in Linux and comes with every Microsoft install for free,
mm-hmm,
is the blue screen of death. I just can't make Ubuntu do it.
Well, I have a screensaver that does that.
Oh, do you? I'm sorry. Whatever you were doing, you're screwed now. And you have to reboot.
In fact, it doesn't really run under Linux, so you have to simulate the blue screen of death by turning
your
computer off. So
yeah, sometimes I get nostalgic.
Yeah.
You know, I've been working for 3 hours here. There's no way I'm going to lose any of this.
I don't miss that. And certainly the costs of installing Linux compared with Windows are one thing, but a lot of people have a lot of other reasons for moving to Linux as well. But before we leave the cost, one thing I want to make sure we don't overlook is we've talked a little bit about the cost of installing the operating system and an office suite.
Right.
But for the average installation of Linux, there is so much software that comes with it pre-installed that if you try to add in the equivalent Windows programs for everything you get out of the box with a Linux installation, you suddenly get into thousands and thousands of dollars. For example, in our situation where we had someone whose computer crashed and they decided to deck it out with the latest Windows Vista, we went with Ultimate, got the top-of-the-line Microsoft Office package. Without counting any hardware upgrades, we're up to over $1,000 just with that, $1,080 according to the total. But now, when you consider that Linux comes with an advanced graphics editing program, the GIMP, the equivalent software for that would be Photoshop Premiere Elements, Let's just not even go whole hog on Photoshop. Let's just go with Premiere Elements, $150 for that. There is a website authoring program that might come with your version of Linux. NView is the one that I use. There are plenty of them out there that allow you to do HTML coding for your websites and things like that. So let's say you go with the latest offering from Microsoft that allows you to do web authoring. It's called Microsoft SharePoint Designer. That's $260. And for what we're using here for the podcast, for example, if we wanted to record audio, we're using Audacity, which is an open source project, which doesn't come on many operating systems.
But it's available in the repository. Exactly. A couple of clicks, you got it.
You've got it. And so let's say you were to purchase, Avid Express Pro as a Windows audio editing software package, $1,497. So just to do what we're doing here on the podcast, to do graphics editing for the website, website authoring, and audio editing, we would, if we had done this with a Windows Vista computer, buying the top of the line of everything from Microsoft, we would have almost $3,000 just in software without counting the cost of the hardware, the cost of your previous operating system, or the cost of anything else you've had in the past. And a grand total to do all of this on Linux is zero. No cost. Nothing at all.
And here's something else. As you're installing all of these packages in Windows, when you boot up, each application will kind of halfway load so that it can come up quickly if you ever need it. You don't see that so much in Linux. If you want an application, the code is clean enough and fast enough that it comes up in about the same amount of time from zero, starting from scratch, that it does in Windows. And here's Windows using all of these resources to keep it ready, to have it halfway running in the background.
Yeah, you're talking about those little assistant programs that they have that help things start faster by preloading them into RAM.
Well, yeah, if you've got, as I recall, RealPlayer under Windows, or even, what's their email program again? Outlook.
Yeah.
Is sort of already running before you open it.
Yeah, that's true. And even something like the Adobe Reader, where you're reading PDFs, they have a little assistant program that runs in the system tray to help Adobe Reader start faster.
Right.
And by the time you get all of these little assistant programs running, you've used up a good chunk of your RAM, which of course causes your computer to run slower.
Sure, so, and you're not even using them yet.
Yeah, exactly.
You've just booted, and a lot of your resources are already gone.
Yeah. Let's go on and talk about the pluses of Linux. And we've talked a little bit about the cost. And, of course, the cost is really important to nonprofit organizations. It's important to starving artists and students and authors who don't have the money to purchase software willy-nilly. And to be able to take a computer that you scrounged from your brother who was upgrading to something and gave you his old one, or you went and you purchased a low-cost computer, you can really get some powerful software installed on there by just installing from one live CD a Linux distribution, and then you're up and running and ready to go for just about anything you need. And if you don't have everything you need, it's a few clicks away on a repository somewhere.
Sure. And you go to open something and it says, hey, sorry, you don't have the latest version of this. Here's a website where you can go and get it. Then you have to navigate to the website, figure out what it is you have to download and how to install it and do the upgrade. In Linux, if there's a new version, you get a new version of anything installed on your system. There's a little icon that comes up, at the upper top right of the screen, at least in GNOME, and it says, hey, there's new updates available. You want them?
Mm-hmm.
What's your password? And there you go. It's done.
Yeah.
Never have to fool with that again.
Yeah, and on the KDE desktop environment, it's in the lower right-hand corner, but a little icon comes up there as well. And the best part of the whole thing, Tom, I think, is the fact that after you're finished installing, you just use the program. You don't have to reboot your computer.
Right. Well, unless it's upgraded the kernel.
Exactly, of course, if you're changing the brain of the computer. I think it's fair to ask to reboot. But if you're
and
just...
even then, it'll keep running. It'll just say the changes aren't going to happen until after you reboot.
Exactly. It just keeps running the old kernel until
sure.
you have rebooted your computer. So I think that's a really powerful productivity advantage in Linux.
It sure is. Yeah. And it's a no-brainer.
Exactly.
You don't have to go to a website and figure out the hoops you need to jump through to get it done.
Right. One of the things that new Linux users find a little frustrating is the fact that you don't have to go or you don't get to go to websites and just click on the .exe file and install the program. You actually have to know a little bit about the program you're installing before you install it, either the name or what it does or things like that.
Yeah. If you're going from the package manager, though, you just look around. You can search. You know, I want some kind of MP3 program. You can search for MP3, and it'll tell you all the programs that are available that have that in it.
Right. Yeah, and for people moving from Windows, though, that's kind of a foreign concept, that everything you would want would be there in a candy store, and all you have to do is put something about it into a search field, and you'll find it. To have everything all in one place seems a little strange. Very convenient, but a little strange.
yeah. Which reminds me, when I first switched over from Windows, and this is going to sound weird, I missed ScanDisk and Defrag. You know, it got so much to be a part of my routine, to every couple of days or every week do the maintenance on it.
Yep.
And you go to Linux, and there's nothing like that has to be done.
Yeah, you don't have to defrag at all. And I've noticed, depending on which file system you have for your Linux installation, whether it's a Riser file system or some of the other technical details as to which kind of file system you have, it may go and do an equivalent of a scan disk about every 30 or so times you reboot.
Yeah, it does do that. Every 30th time I boot, it says, check in the disk.
Yeah, so it does check the disk.
Disk is okay, and then it boots.
But you don't have to take the initiative to go and remember
no.
to do it. It just does it.
And speaking of that, booting 30 times on a Linux system, that can be many weeks apart.
Or many months.
Right.
Yeah.
Because you don't have your system slowing down hour by hour like you do in a Windows system.
Mm-hmm.
I remember having packages that were kind of hogs for system resource hogs, and try to open them and they'd run slow. Okay, well, Windows has been running for 3 days now. I have to reboot.
Yeah.
You don't see that in Linux either.
Yeah, that's true. That is very true.
Your first shot at anything when you run into trouble in Windows is try rebooting. Mm-hmm. See if that helps.
And it usually does.
Yeah.
Which says something. I'm not sure what, but it can't be good.
How about community?
How about community? There is definitely a sense of community. We got an email from one of our listeners just talking about that recently, about the fact that, here's the scenario. Gentleman wrote to us and asked us a question, new convert to Linux, and asked us a question, and I answered it. I answered it fairly thoroughly, and his response was, and you'll hear this email in the listener feedback episode next, but his response to me was something like, wow, you guys really responded quickly and thoroughly, and if we had support like this in Windows, people wouldn't be migrating to Linux nearly as quickly as they are. And I think the migration, the rate of migration to Linux has increased lately.
Oh, yeah, it has. It's accelerated.
Yeah, I'm not exactly sure how to put my finger on it, but it just seems that way. But you're right. Community is all about people helping people. And that's what Linux is about.
You're not going to start singing again.
No, no, okay. No. I wouldn't put our audience through that.
Okay. Yeah, that if you get stuck in Windows, you can make out, and let's try not to laugh, a trouble ticket.
I couldn't help. Sorry.
Okay. Which, of course, is taken very seriously and never goes into a black hole, and they'll help you every time. On the Linux side of things, there are Wikipedia-type sites. There are forums that you can go to and ask questions, and you actually get answers. There are people out there just waiting to help. It's wonderful.
Yeah, and this is something that people find absolutely astonishing when they first get into Linux. When you ask for help on a software application, a good portion of the time, the person that offers you the help is the person who wrote the program.
Exactly.
Or one of the people who wrote the program.
Or if you run into a bug, or you say, you know, I'd like it a lot more if it worked this way instead of the way it does right now, you can go to those people online, fill out a form, and either do your bug report or your wish list, and it'll be addressed.
Yeah. Yeah, it just, it's amazing. It's just amazing. It's like, oh, we never thought of that. Okay, yeah. We'll do that.
Yeah, that'd be cool. The thing is, you don't have a department full of employees working on these things. You've got many, many enthusiastic volunteers that love doing this kind of thing. And you've got people who are purposely trying to break it and break into it and find security flaws so that they can be patched, and the patches are automatic.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to wait for the next service pack to come around.
That's one of the things that makes Linux a lot more secure than the equivalent Windows components, is the fact that because you have so many people looking at the program itself, the code behind the program, and looking for problems, that when they do come up, whether it's a result of a bug in the system or the result of someone writing an attempt at a virus or some sort of malware to find a way into your computer through that program, those people, those many, many people looking at this program constantly through its development, find that quickly, patch it quickly, and send it out on your next update, which comes to you automatically. As you said, you don't have to wait for the next service pack to be able to address a security problem.
It just gets
fixed. Yeah.
And on the Microsoft side, you do have many, many, many enthusiastic volunteers who are trying to find ways to break it, and that's all.
Yeah. So that's the security end of things. Well, there's more to the security end of things. I mean, we did a whole series of episodes on firewalls. I think the conclusion was, at least in your case, that you were fine running Linux without a firewall.
Still am.
You know, security is less of an issue with Linux. I think it's going to become more of an issue as more and more people begin to use Linux, and Linux becomes more of a target for the malware authors. But I don't think Linux is inherently as vulnerable simply because there are many more people looking at the code and looking for vulnerabilities.
Right. You don't have to assign a bunch of employees to go fix that hole. It's volunteers doing it.
Yeah.
And, okay, why not switch to Linux? Why don't people make the switch? And I think the biggest part of that is fear of change. And that's a basic human trait. Even if something isn't great, we get comfortable with it, in changing, well, change sounds bad. Take my word for it. In this case, change is good. You can get 1 foot in the Linux pool. You can go dual boot. You don't have to change all at once. You can come over and try it out and use the system. Use it once in a while. Use it more often. Get comfortable with it. And you'll still have all your Linux applications and all your viruses running. They won't go anywhere. And once you're comfortable on the Linux side, I think you're going to follow us and just move away from what you're using now.
Yeah, I think you're right. There's a lot of inertia there, people not willing to change or not wanting to change or just feeling that they've changed enough. Enough is enough. I'm just going to stick with what I've got. But there are also the folks that would like to change, but they are just not confident that their favorite software application is available on Linux.
And it might not be.
And it might not be. But again, there are lots of different ways to handle that. There are a lot of software applications that are available for Linux that do almost as much as, or exactly as much as,
or more than.
In some cases more than, yes, the Windows equivalent software program. But if you can't find your favorite Windows program under Linux, a couple of things you can do is, as you mentioned, Tom, you can dual boot. And so when you want to use your favorite Windows application, you boot into Windows. And when you are using your Linux applications, you simply boot into Linux. However, you can also use emulator programs or programs like Wine under Linux that allow you to run your Windows program not natively under Linux but in an environment within Linux that allows a Windows program to run
securely.
Securely, exactly. So there are a number of ways around this, and again, just the other day we received an email from someone who wanted to run their tax preparation software.
Oh, right, right. Good email.
Provided by their tax preparer, and they don't offer a Linux version. So I did a little bit of checking into whether or not that particular tax software runs under Wine. A quick Google search and a visit to Wine HQ, and I found out that, yes, it runs perfectly under Wine.
There you go.
And the program on the CD comes with a number of different EXE programs. A couple of them run directly under Wine, and there were a couple of others you wanted to stay away from. But all of that was documented by the Wine community on the Wine site, and there were plenty of posts in forums around the internet as well. So,
sure. Now these days, when I sit down at a Windows computer, I look around and my favorite stuff isn't there.
Yeah, you know, because your favorite stuff is the Linux applications. Yeah.
Now, what's the equivalent of what I'm using over in Windows? I don't remember.
There isn't one. Yeah, for someone moving from Linux to Windows, heaven forbid, it would be the same situation where, just as you say, your favorite Linux application isn't available in Windows or isn't available on the Mac or isn't available on your Sun Unix workstation or whatever else is out there to move to.
You know, that's right. Equal time. We haven't bashed Macintosh at all. So
yeah, we can bash away.
I don't want Bill to think we're picking on him.
Yeah, yeah. Let's spread the wealth here a little bit.
Sure.
The hardest part about Apple computers is the fact that the hardware costs so much.
Oh, but it's a status symbol.
Of course, it's very well designed. It's beautiful.
Yeah.
And all sarcasm aside, it really is really nice hardware.
It is.
I'm just not willing to pay the additional premium.
No.
Anyway, we don't know an awful lot about Macintosh, so
no,
I think that's the extent of our bashing there.
Okay. We got it in, though, Bill.
Yeah, we'll leave that to Klaatu over at the Bad Apples podcast. He can do the Apple bashing for us.
He's good.
He is good. And in fact, later on in this episode, I have an interview with Klaatu.
Oh, cool.
I attended the Southern California Linux Expo, or SCALE, And
hey, did anybody walk up to you and say aardvark?
No aardvarks, no armadillos, no none of that. In fact,
so you didn't have to buy any
beers?
No,
I didn't have to buy any beers, and
Well, how did you like the expo? What was it like?
The expo was wonderful. I was only there for one day, but I sat in on some of the talks, and I sat in on some of the other things going on. I walked through the exhibit. Klaatu and I spent some time kind of hanging out together after his talk on video codecs. He's a movie maker and a video editor, and in addition to being a podcaster. And he was giving a talk on another part of Linux, which is the fact that the video codecs and the audio codecs, which are the little programs that allow your computer to actually use or play or record, in
right.
some cases, the audio or the video. So he was giving a talk on that and what is legal to use, what is not legal to use, and how can you tell the difference, and which should you use, and gave some examples of some of his video work, showed it up on the screen. It was really interesting. But the conference itself, lots of Linux and Linux-related software and hardware being displayed. And
did you get any freebies because you're a podcaster?
Freebies? Well, I got free entry into the into Scale because I'm a podcaster.
Oh, cool.
And, of course, in exchange for that, they want us to talk about Scale, which, of course, we're doing right now. So I guess we're holding up our
end. Oh, I didn't realize that we were covering a provision.
Well, I think that's implied. That's, us holding up our end of the bargain here. So,
sure.
But other freebies, I got some free Linux CDs. I didn't get as much as I got last year in terms of free swag. But this year, I spent most of my time, quite frankly, talking to people in the booths about what it is they were doing and looking at the various things that were going on and just observing. One of the things I observed at Scale was the fact that this year I only saw two computers in any of the booths that were running Windows. I say,
really?
If you can believe it, at a Linux conference, there were actually some people there demonstrating software that was being demonstrated using Windows. And I'm not exactly sure why they were doing that, but...
Yeah, that was my question. Why?
Yeah, I don't know. I never got up the guts to ask them. But there were only two booths where that... And last year, there were more. The other trend I noticed is that there were a lot more new Linux users at the show this year than there were last year. And Klaatu mentioned that to me as well, that he observed that. He was hanging out in the Ubuntu booth for a little while, and he noticed that this year there seemed to be a lot more new Linux users than he expected. And one last trend, a lot more Macintosh hardware. Last year, you saw maybe four or five Macs in the whole conference between the attendees and the people demonstrating things in the various booths. But this year, everywhere you turn, there seemed to be a MacBook Pro. I didn't see any MacBook Airs yet, but there was somebody there with an Intel Mac running some version, some flavor of Linux on it.
Uh-huh.
So I think we're beginning to infiltrate the Apple. But no,
we have agents everywhere.
Yeah. Seriously, though, I did notice a preponderance of Macintosh hardware at the conference this year as compared with last year. So
it's good hardware.
It is. Interesting stuff.
And I think Macintosh is Unix-based in the first place, isn't it?
It is. It's something they call Darwin. I talked with Klaatu a little bit about this kind of offline. Their version of Unix in the background is something called Darwin, which isn't exactly Linux. It is derived from Unix, but it's not...
not open source.
No, certainly not open source, and it's not something that... Apple likes to make a big deal about. They seem to want to have it as a closed environment, a proprietary environment. And given that Unix tends to have this funky little branch called Linux that's open source. I think the Apple Corporation likes to ignore that to some degree.
Sure.
And, of course, that's what the Bad Apples podcast is all about, exposing that whole open source potential in Apple computer.
Well, I think we've about covered that as much as we want to.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you've got an interview, you say?
Yeah, I think maybe this is the appropriate time to play that interview. So this is my interview with Klaatu of the Bad Apples podcast at Scale 6X this year.
Let's listen.
Okay, we're here at Scale 6X in Los Angeles, and I'm with Klaatu of the Bad Apples podcast. Hi, Klaatu.
Hey, how's it going?
Pretty good. Hey, I'm glad to finally meet you.
I am very glad to meet you.
So it's been a while since I've been listening to your podcast, and I know that not only are you the host of Bad Apples, but you are also a video editor and a movie maker, and you're into a lot of things, but you use Linux, and that's kind of an unusual combination.
Yeah.
I wanted to take the opportunity, since we're here together at the show, to talk a little bit about some of the things that you do.
Yeah.
I caught your talk on video codecs.
Video codecs in the free world.
Very good talk, by the way.
Thank you.
And I found it very interesting. And what I'd like to do is, since the Going Linux audience is new users of Linux, primarily, we've got a few experienced users who are building their competence and confidence with the operating system, as we say.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's a great show for everyone, I think. I listen to it all the time, learn something every time. Yeah.
Well, thanks.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to kind of focus on some of the questions that new Linux users or users new to Linux or moving to Linux have about codecs, because one of the things that catches people by surprise is when you install Linux for the first time, not everything works, especially in the audio and the video world, and much of that is due to the fact that when you install Linux, it doesn't by default have all of the codecs to play things like MP3 or MPEG or those kinds of things. So what can you tell us about that?
Well, the reason, I mean, you say it doesn't work, and it doesn't work, but it can't. It's not because it can't work.
It doesn't work out of the box.
But it does work. It's not fair, because these codecs, a lot of people don't realize that when they go out and buy a computer and they buy that operating system on the computer, some of that money that they're paying for, they're paying for those codecs.
Right.
They're actually paying a licensing fee to an organization called MPEG, which stands for the Motion Picture Experts Group. And that, as I said in my presentation, is not a name that they've earned or anything like that. They just decided to call themselves
the call
expert
ourselves.
Group.
So you
should call yourself the Going Linux Expert Group or something
like
that.
Hey, Tom and I will do that.
Exactly, because, I mean, it's arbitrary. So they've got these codecs, and unfortunately they're so prevalent that they've become almost standards. And some, in fact, have become standards, like the MPEG 4. That's actually an ISO. It's a standard. So when you're getting Linux, you know, a lot of your media might not play on Linux unless you install a lot of different what are called codecs, which are basically the secret ring decoders that play all the media that an industry has made that supports, you know, this licensing fee business model.
Right.
So the easiest way usually is to install like GStreamer plugins and things like that, which typically are basically just some resourceful programmer out there has decoded all of it for us and has written a program that will play it. One of the best ones for this is called VLC Player.
Right.
It's just basically a one-click install. It's just really easy to install, and it'll play practically anything you throw at it, so it's really kind of nice.
Mm-hmm.
But there are still exceptions, because part of the codec idea is that you can't get to it unless you've paid a lot of money to get to it.
Yeah. And my understanding is that there are some codecs out there which, as an individual, if you wanted to go and purchase, you know, pay somebody so that you could use it legally, there's really no mechanism for doing that.
You're wrong.
Okay. Correct me.
There's a thing called Fluendo.
All right.
Fluendo.
Mm-hmm.
Which is basically a bunch of guys went out to like MPEG and all these different organizations, so many that I can't actually even remember. I just like to pick on MPEG because they're the biggest one. They go to these places and say, hey, we would like to buy the license to sell these codecs, the permission to use these codecs. And they do. And then you pay Fluendo, and so you're buying the license fee. You're paying the license fees. And I think it actually literally goes by a yearly fee, but it's not a lot of money. It's like, it's as if though you were to, you know, if you bought like Windows or Mac OS on a disk to install,
right.
It's about, you know, you're going to be paying about the same amount probably in total. So you pay for these codecs, and then you get to play all your media, and you're completely legal, it's permissive, it's no one's going to have a problem with it, it's totally fine. You're absolutely allowed to do that.
So is Fluendo an application or a plug-in?
It's a plug-in.
Okay.
So basically a codec is just a little file that sits on your hard drive, and a program, a media player, kind of says, do I have this, I guess you could call it a plug-in, if it sees it on the hard drive, it can use it and play it back for you. If it doesn't see it, it'll look to see if there's a free and open alternative, and if there's not even that, or if you don't want to install that, then it just won't play it.
Okay.
And there is a little bit of a legal question about, like, can I install this? I mean, even though a programmer has gone out and completely reinvented the code, like just reverse engineered it and everything like that, there's still an argument, I guess, and it's all, of course, a big gray area. There's still an argument that, oh, you're not allowed to install that free codec because you didn't pay for it, so you still aren't allowed to watch that media, even though you already bought the movie on DVD or you paid for the download, all that other good stuff.
Right.
It's just a big gray area.
Yeah, I know it's a little disconcerting as well when you start up something like GStreamer and it says, do you want to install these restricted drivers?
Right, yes.
And then when you go to install them, it has all these warnings and things,
and
may be illegal and all of
that.
So that can be a little frightening. In fact, we had a listener write into us and wrote us an email. Yeah, it was listener Richard who wrote in on February 6th. He said, when trying to play a podcast on Linux, I see Totem or GStreamer ask to install codecs from the restricted repositories.
Yes.
I see that there's some cautionary text warning not to use this as it may be illegal / immoral / naughty / icky to use in your country. I stopped there. His question is, does Linux not play MPEG format? If not, is there a utility to convert MP3 to OGG? And that's a very typical new Linux user question.
Yeah.
Just what we're talking about here.
Yeah.
So it's kind of the misconception that Linux doesn't work with these things. So it can be very, very confusing.
Well, because somehow the MPEG and the other societies have made it like illegal to be able to play that media without their specific codec.
Mm-hmm.
So even if you could transcode it, which you can, if you transcode the MPEG 3 or the MPEG file to something else, having transcoded it is still a legal gray area, as I understand it. I'm not a lawyer. I'm not giving legal advice. But that is still kind of a gray area. But there are definitely, VLC will actually transcode. There's, if you go to the file menu, go down to the wizard section, it will actually transcode the file into another format. And there's also a lot of command line ones like FFmpeg, FFmpeg2, that's the number 2, Fiora.
Right, and we'll have that information in the show notes so people know how to spell all that stuff.
Right, and I can send you some code for like the typical, you know, transcoding, you know, command line stuff. But like I say, it's still kind of a legal gray area because you've still decoded the MPEG without the license fee, you know? And that in itself is apparently a big question mark. And the good news is that people aren't coming around knocking on doors saying, do you use Linux?
Right.
Are you playing any MPEGs on your Linux box? You know, so
these guys are interested more in enforcing those regulations against the big corporations that are selling the stuff by volume, not by knocking on grandma's door and finding out.
Yeah.
You know.
Do I have GStreamer on my box? Yes, I do. You know, I mean, of course. I think most Linux users do. If Fedora is kind of interesting in that when you first install it, you actually don't have like any of that stuff, and it's kind of hard, if I recall correctly, to even install it on there.
Mm-hmm.
But it's kind of cool to just have this pure environment where you can just play like free codecs like OGG and Xvid and things like that.
Yeah, but one of the things about the Going Linux podcast is we're about, and Tom might take a little issue with this, but we're about practical advice for using Linux, and practically speaking, you've got to be compatible with, with what's out there in the real world.
Yeah. So, especially if you've invested all this money in MP3s, like I think most people have, really. I mean, unless they were just born into Linux, most of us have MP3s and stuff like that. But yeah, we're not just going to lose all that stuff because we're going to Linux. So.
Yeah. Well, thanks for helping out Richard with his question.
Not a problem, Richard.
Since we're here at Scale, I couldn't let the opportunity pass to talk about the show a little bit and, and ask you what your impressions were.
Wow, I'm super excited to be here because I'm helping out with the Ubuntu booth, the Ubuntu local California team. That's a lot of fun. We're seeing a lot of new Linux users actually just kind of coming up and saying, hey, I've heard about Ubuntu. Let me look at it and we see it. You know, we show it off and it's really cool. But, I mean, there's just so many booths here. Like, I mean, I want to talk to, like, everyone, Debian and Fedora and KDE. Like, all the programs that I use, I mean, there's representatives from all of them right here.
Yeah, it's a great expo to be at.
Yeah.
And with that, let's give us both an opportunity to go talk to some of these guys.
But,
so we'll wrap this
up.
Okay, thanks very much for being on the show with us.
Not a problem, Larry.
Great.
Excellent interview, Larry. Thanks, Kletu.
Yeah, I appreciate him taking the time. I know it was a little bit noisy with all the people in the background.
It was, but you can hear what's going on.
Yeah, I think it came out okay.
And I learned a lot about codecs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's kind of interesting that in an open source and free world, we're still saddled with the whole idea of having to pay people to use something, to play something on our computers that is freely available on the internet, but it's not really free because you have to have the codec and you're supposed to pay for it and all that
stuff. Right, a license for it.
Big mess. But, it's manageable and it's easy to install them. So
that's the thing, manageable.
Yeah.
Okay, so I think we're about ready to wrap it up, Larry, for this episode.
Okay. Yeah, I agree. And what do we have on for next episode, Tom? Oh, it's a listener feedback episode.
Listener feedback.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that. We've got some good emails and some good voicemails from people as well. Until then, you can go to the articles and show notes on our website at goinglinux.com for more information and detailed instructions on the topics we cover with screenshots.
And you can email us with comments, questions, and suggestions. Send us an audio comment by email or leave it on our listener feedback line and we'll play it on the show. The feedback line is 206-350-5251 and put a plus one in front of that if you're Skyping. And our email address is goinglinux@gmail.com.
Of course, you can download our episodes from our website or you can subscribe to the podcast to get future episodes delivered to your computer automatically. Instructions on how to do that are on our website. Thanks for listening.
Talk to you later.
Theme music provided by Mark Blasco at podcastthemes.com.